Welcome to Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ehlich, and I'm your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And today is Sunday, April 20th, 2025. Clothes are in the news. From Climate Solutions, three actually, one written in July, one written in August, and one written last week in April 2025. First, from July 5th, 2024, why scientists think they may finally have a way to recycle clothes. From the Washington Post, it's almost impossible to turn old threads into new clothes, but scientists are working to change that. By Nicolas Rivero. Nearly all your clothes will wind up burned or in a landfill, but scientists are coming up with new ways to recycle those fabrics into new clothes or useful products. A critical step, though, will be figuring out how to handle blended fabrics that combine different materials, mainly cotton and polyester, into one piece of cloth. Once the fibers are blended together, it's hard to separate one material from the others so that each can be recycled separately. Researchers at the University of Delaware are proposing a new recycling technique that breaks down blended fabrics using chemicals and microwaves. The researchers say the process takes 15 minutes and can dissolve any blend of cotton, polyester, nylon, and spandex into molecules that can be used to make new fabrics or products like dyes, electronics, and tires. Catch-all recycling techniques like this one could be a last line of defense to keep clothing out of the dump, according to Tasha Lewis, an associate clinical professor in fashion and retail studies at Ohio State University. There are other solutions to fashion waste that are simpler and cheaper. People can buy secondhand clothing and make their wardrobes last longer. Companies can make garments more durable and make them out of one material so they're easier to recycle. Worn-out textiles can be chopped up and used as insulation in buildings. But when there are no other options, chemical recycling could save the day. This would be the final stage for the leftovers that just have no other purpose, said Lewis. The state of textile recycling. The need to recycle clothing is becoming more urgent, along with the rise of fast fashion, the business model where retailers churn out cheap, flimsy clothes quickly to keep up with ever-changing fashion trends. The world now throws out 92 million tons of clothes a year, and only about an eighth of it gets recycled, according to an analysis from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, a nonprofit focused on recycling. The rest winds up in landfills or incinerators, where it pollutes the air and water. Most of the clothes that are recycled get downcycled, meaning they're shredded into a less valuable material that's used for things like padding or insulation. Less than 1% of all garments get turned into a new piece of clothing, according to the Ellen MacArthur Foundation. That rare form of recycling is key to many environmentalists' and fashion designers' vision for a future where most clothes are made from recycled fabrics, and the same fibers can be used again and again in new garments. Ideally, if we recycled all textile waste, we would have enough materials forever, and we wouldn't need to produce new materials, said Miriam Riboul, a senior research fellow in materials circularity at the Royal College of Art in London. Today, that happens in a small number of facilities that take old fabric and turn it into new fibers and new yarns. Just as glass and metal can be melted down and remolded into new products, synthetic fabrics like polyester can be melted into plastic pellets and turned back into fibers. And just as paper can be churned into pulp and rolled into new sheets, natural fibers like cotton can be shredded and spun into new yarns. Most of these plants focus on just one type of material, such as cotton or polyester, and some struggle to find companies willing to buy their recycled threads, which are often lower quality than new fabrics. Renewcell, a Swedish startup that opened a plant to turn old cotton into new rayon in 2022, filed for bankruptcy in February. What about blended fabrics? The challenge is even harder for blended fabrics that have to be separated before they're recycled. The fashion industry is not always transparent about what's in their clothes, said Erha Andini, the lead author of the University of Delaware study on recycling blended textiles. It's common for retailers to weave a little spandex or nylon into modern garments to make them stretch and help them fit. But they don't always say so on the tag. Companies also rarely list the dyes and finishes they add to fabrics to make them wrinkle-resistant or waterproof. To deal with complicated clothes with mysterious materials, Andini and her colleagues developed a chemical recycling process that strips fabrics down to their molecular studs. Using microwaves and chemical solvents, the researchers can break the bonds that hold synthetic fibers together, leaving behind the basic molecules used to make polyester, nylon, and spandex, along with intact cotton fibers. The molecules can be turned back into fibers for clothing or used to make other products, such as seat belts and airbags. Unlike with existing recycling methods, researchers can use this technique even if they don't know exactly what's in a piece of clothing. But they've only demonstrated it in a lab. They say it may take a decade or more for companies to turn the idea into a profitable business. In the meantime, experts say, the fashion industry should also think about other ways to curb waste, such as making garments out of one material so that they're easier to recycle and making less clothing in the first place. We can't just recycle our way out of this issue, said Sophie Scanlon, a textiles specialist at WRAP, a British nonprofit, RAP, focused on waste. We really need to tackle the root issue of why are we producing and consuming greater and greater quantities of clothing. What readers were saying in response to this article. The comments reflect a strong concern about the environmental impact of fast fashion and the need for sustainable practices. Many suggest reducing consumption, buying quality clothing that lasts, and recycling. There is also a call for systemic changes. This first of three articles on the challenge of recycling clothing appeared on July 5, 2024, as part of the Washington Post's ongoing series, Climate Solutions. This one is entitled, Why Scientists Think They May Finally Have Found a Way to Recycle Clothes. It's almost impossible to turn old threads into new clothes, but scientists are working to change that. Next, the most recent of the three articles, again in the Washington Post under Climate Solutions, but this one posted on April 5th, 2025. These recycling techniques could help keep clothes out of landfills. Researchers are experimenting with using static electricity and other techniques to separate the components of hard-to-recycle mixed fabrics. By Allison Chu. Each year, as tens of billions of garments are made, countless unwanted clothes end up discarded, often destined for landfills or incineration. The fast fashion industry often gets blamed for encouraging people to buy more than they need and for making clothes that don't last long. But another problem with all those spring must-haves is that recycling textiles can be difficult, especially when so much clothing is, you guessed it, made out of a combination of fibers. A key challenge, experts say, is figuring out how to sort and separate materials in a way that makes them reusable in new clothing. And we hear from experts that were not mentioned in the previous article. For example, Karen Pearson, chair of the Sustainability Council at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, says, most of our garments themselves, the majority are not made from a kind of monofiber fabric. It's hard to get back to a point of pureness, and how you can treat and refabricate the textile is based on how pure it is. But she and other experts said, efforts to improve and expand textile recycling are underway. But first, why don't more clothes get recycled? Out of all the textiles produced, the Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, estimates that about 85% wind up in the garbage or incinerated. Less than 1% of the material used to make clothing is recycled into new garments, according to a 2017 report from the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, a British nonprofit focused on promoting a circular economy. The difficulty starts with collection, said Amanda Forster, a materials research engineer at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, NIST. There isn't a centralized collection infrastructure for textiles in the United States, Forster said, noting that it often falls to charities, such as Goodwill, to take in unwanted clothes and figure out what to do with them. Trying to make the best decisions about every single individual item in there is a big, big challenge, Forster said. Once these garments are collected, recyclers must sort all the material by type, a process complicated by blended fabrics. Sorting and detangling blended textiles, which can be a mix of natural and synthetic fibers, can be costly and time-consuming. Previously used fibers also aren't always accepted by textile mills, said Abigail Clark Sather, an associate professor of mechanical and industrial engineering at the University of Minnesota in Duluth. Many mills have strict technical specifications about the length and purity of the fibers they will take. Cotton fibers, for instance, typically need to be at least an inch or an inch and a half long, Clark Sather said. They want the input quality of materials so they know they can get the output quality of yarn, of thread, that can become the output of fabric that their large retailer customers are asking for, said Clark Sather, who researches textile recycling. So how can recycling textiles be improved? Research is ongoing to make sorting textiles more efficient and accurate. Near-infrared spectroscopy, which measures how much light passes through or scatters off fabric, is one approach. The method produces a unique pattern that can act as a fingerprint to identify the types of fibers in clothing. In January of this year, NIST scientists released a database of these molecular fingerprints to help recycling centers sort materials more rapidly. Researchers are also experimenting with using static electricity to separate different fibers. When fibers rub against each other, they can pick up a charge. A natural fiber, such as cotton, will have more of a positive charge, whereas a synthetic, like polyester, will become negatively charged. When exposed to an electric field, the positively charged cotton fibers can be pulled apart from the negatively charged polyester fibers, said Katrina Guge, a postdoctoral researcher at NIST who has studied this method. It's using intrinsic properties to the fibers, Guge said. If there is a blend in there that you weren't able to pick up on during the sorting process, it can still sort that itself. While working on electrostatic separation is nascent, Guge said it could become part of a mechanical recycling system, which involves shredding textiles into fibers. But shredding causes fibers to degrade and become shorter over time, experts said. Shorter fiber lengths can affect material performance, leading to issues such as shedding and pilling. Mechanical recycling can also have an environmental cost, in part because the process typically requires energy and water. Chemical sorting and recycling is another method being studied that can create virgin quality materials from used fabrics, said Amber Herkinen, circular business manager with Circulose, a brand that makes new material out of textile waste. Similar to mechanical recycling, chemical recycling at this point can involve some environmental trade-offs. It requires water and heat, along with the use of chemicals. Still, Herkinen said recycling textiles mechanically or chemically can still be better for the planet than making virgin materials the old-fashioned way, such as conventionally grown cotton. Experts are also studying biological processes that use naturally occurring enzymes and could have a substantially smaller environmental impact compared to synthetic chemicals, some of which might be derived from fossil fuels, Pearson said. It's critical, she and other experts said, to continue developing all available recycling techniques. There's lots of processes that can create usable fibers, Clark Sather said. The question is, are there fiber mills that are willing to accept and innovate and experiment with those fibers? The demand for recycled material exists, she added. Consumers want to wear recycled fibers, she said. They want to do the right thing. And what readers said in response to this article written just last week. The comments highlight several challenges and perspectives on recycling textiles made from blended fibers. Many who commented emphasized the importance of reducing consumption and reusing clothing to mitigate environmental impact, rather than relying solely on recycling. But armed with all this information, the problem still exists. What do you look for when you go shopping? Well, we turn to a third Climate Solution article, this one published last August 13, 2024, and written by Anna Kramer. The one thing you should look for on clothing labels when you go shopping. When Megyn Kelly goes clothes shopping, she scans labels for a key number, 100%. She picks garments made of 100% cotton, 100% wool, and occasionally 100% polyester, avoiding fabrics that blend natural and synthetic materials together whenever possible. I am a fabric purist, said Kelly, who is a professor of textile design at Thomas Jefferson University. It might seem that fabrics made with plastics, such as polyester, would be more environmentally friendly if they had some natural fibers mixed in. But, as we've already heard, when plastic and natural fibers are combined into one fabric, it becomes more difficult to care for and reuse over the course of its life. Blended fabrics are one reason clothes recycling is still rare and why heaps of them pile up in landfills. Sorting and detangling blended textiles is costly and time-consuming. Accidentally allowing too much of a synthetic fiber, such as spandex, into the recycling stream can cause the whole process to break down, destroying the machines. Yet clothing made of natural synthetic blends, such as cotton and elastane, a material often used for denim jeans, is increasingly common, said Georgia Parker, the innovation director at the apparel sustainability initiative Fashion for Good. In Europe, nearly a third of all clothes are made with these fabrics. Our findings underscore the prevalence of blended fabrics in the industry, Parker said. So, here's what you need to know about what fabrics to pick the next time you're shopping. First, the problem with blended fabrics. Compared to 100% natural fibers, linen, cotton, wool, for example, or other biodegradable materials such as viscose or rayon, which is made from a wood-like fiber, blended synthetic fabrics can be more durable and withstand more stress. They can also feel softer and smoother. And perhaps more importantly, they can be cheaper, according to textiles researchers. That low cost makes the fast fashion problem worse, inspiring people to buy more than they need. The average American buys more than one new piece of clothing per week. Because they're not easily recyclable, these textiles eventually end up in landfills, both within and outside the U.S., typically in countries such as India, Pakistan, and China. That means the resources that went into making them are essentially wasted, said Karen Leonis, a professor of textiles sciences at North Carolina State University. Clothes made out of natural fibers, such as cotton or linen, are easier to take apart and recycle, though there are few facilities to process even those materials. Still, experts say that recycling technology is improving and that apparel companies will invest in it if enough customers signal they want their clothes to be more sustainable. The consumer really drives the product that goes out there, Leonis said. If consumers were demanding 100% single-fiber products, and they were willing to pay for it, there's a return on investment that companies can get from that if they launch buyback and recycling programs. So, when you're shopping, what you should look for in a label. First of all, avoid blends with synthetic materials. Polyester, acrylic, and spandex shed plastic fibers every time they are washed in a machine. Washing synthetic textiles is the single greatest contributor to ocean microplastics, which eventually enter the food chain, animals' bodies, and our own bodies. The exact health effects of microplastics are still unknown, but researchers are concerned they could be causing or exacerbating serious health problems. While clothing made of natural fibers also releases fragments in the wash, those materials will biodegrade. Polyester doesn't go away, so by its very nature, not demanding its presence helps us keep it in check, Kelly said. But if choosing between a blended fabric and 100% polyester, go with the pure polyester garment. Because polyester fibers are made of plastic, they can be easily recycled and reused over and over again. Enough polyester clothing exists today that the fashion industry should never need to make any more new material, said Becky Flax, a colleague of Kelly's at Jefferson University's Textiles Design Program. Labels will often indicate if clothing is made from recycled polyester. Natural fiber blends can be okay. When choosing between different kinds of biodegradable and natural material fibers and fabrics, you should think about fiber families, Flax said. Different types of cotton, such as recycled cotton and new cotton, will blend well together and be easily separated. And the same goes for cotton and linen blends. By contrast, a mix of wool and cotton is harder to recycle because the two fabric types are so different that they are hard to separate, even though they are both made of biodegradable materials, according to Flax. So you have to know your natural fibers. Natural and biodegradable fabrics are not equal in terms of their environmental impact. Cotton grown organically can create lower greenhouse gas emissions and use less water than conventionally grown cotton. Linen and hemp, both known as bast fibers because they come from the bark of trees that grow like a stalk, require fewer resources to grow and are more durable than cotton, but they can be more difficult to dye and require more water, energy, and chemicals to transform into usable fibers. Wool can be sheared every year from the same sheep, but how that's done and where the sheep are raised will determine how much wool is used, how much is wasted, and whether it's dyed sustainably. Unfortunately, types of wool are rarely labeled for consumers. And then, lyocell, which is made from wood pulp, can be produced with resource-intensive methods and pollute water. But it can also be made in more environmentally friendly ways, Leonis said. Tencel, for example, is certified for sustainability by the EU Eco label. So how on earth do we choose? Each type of fiber has trade-offs, so avoiding natural synthetic blends is not a panacea, Leonis, Kelly, and Flax cautioned. Consumers should read every label and research the materials, treating their clothes as if they are art or an investment, they say. They recommend doing research on the specific company you're purchasing from, looking for where they source their materials, and what certifications, if any, they may have. The more you learn about what you're buying, the better you will care for it. For example, if you know that wool is naturally odor-resistant and absorbs more moisture than many other fibers, you might choose wool-based athletic clothing over synthetic because you can wash it less. And if you're choosing between a new 100% cotton t-shirt or a thrifted one made of a cotton synthetic blend, always opt for thrifted. The bottom line is that diverting it from the landfill is increasing the longevity of the particular product, Leonis said. The comments reflect a diverse range of opinions on clothing materials and consumer habits. Some prefer natural fibers like cotton and wool, while others highlight the benefits of synthetic blends for durability and cost effectiveness. Because I'm a big thrift store shopper, I decided to summarize the advice from this last article, and I hope that this summary will help you shop for clothing as well. The bottom line, buying at a thrift store is better than buying a new item, even if the item is 100% a particular fiber, because buying used will extend the life of the garment. But even when rescuing clothing from a thrift store, keep in mind that buying fabrics that are 100% cotton or 100% linen or even 100% polyester can be more easily recycled when the garment is at the end of its life because the entire garment is one material. If you have to buy a garment that has blended fabrics, then blended natural fibers are easily separated and recycled, unless they are very different, and the example the article gives is wool and cotton. So when shopping, keep the following in mind. First of all, it is best to buy a garment that is 100% one fabric, 100% cotton, 100% linen, even 100% polyester. And don't forget about rayon. Rayon is made from a wood-like fiber and also 100% recyclable. If you have to buy a garment that is blended fibers, then consider blended natural fibers because they are easily separated and can be recycled, such as a blend of cotton and linen. But beware of blended fabrics that are too different. An example is wool and cotton. Above all, avoid blended fabrics that contain a natural fiber and a synthetic. In other words, a fabric, and this is very, very common, that is cotton with a tiny bit of spandex so that the fabric gives a little. But remember that buying any garment at a thrift store is better than a new item, even one that is 100% one fiber, because you are rescuing that garment and getting the most use out of it that you can. Also keep in mind that every time you wash a piece of clothing, it sheds fibers, no matter what the fabric is. However, if the fabric is made of natural fibers, those fibers that are shed are biodegradable. Because clothing made of synthetic fibers also sheds, but because they don't biodegrade, they are the single biggest contributor to ocean microplastics, which eventually enter the food chain, animals' bodies, and our own. For these three articles, our columnists consulted researchers at the University of Delaware, at Ohio State University, their Fashion and Retail Studies Division, at the Ellen MacArthur Foundation, at the Materials Circularity at the Royal College of Art in London, at Renewcell, a Swedish startup, at WRAP, W-R-A-P, a British nonprofit that is focused on waste, at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York, their Sustainability Council, at the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA, at the National Institute of Standards and Technology, or NIST, at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and a business manager at Circulose, a brand that makes new material out of textile waste. All three articles appeared in Climate Solutions in the Washington Post. And now we turn to Science News. The news section, February 2025 issue, in the Department of Plants. This botanist is on a mission to save the Atacama's cacti, by Rebecca Zombach. Paulo Guerrero has been visiting cacti in the Atacama Desert his whole life, first on family trips to the Chilean coast, and later as a researcher studying the impacts of climate change and illegal poaching on the fragile flora. The desert, which is the driest spot on Earth beyond parts of Antarctica, can be so desolate that NASA, the National Aeronautic and Space Administration, uses it to test Mars rovers. But from a young age, Guerrero learned to spot pockets of life hidden within the arid landscape. Cacti, a smorgasbord of funky shapes and showy flowers, easily became his favorite. Guerrero began visiting the Atacama as a researcher in the early 2000s, observing the plants of his childhood with a botanist's eye. Their ability to flourish in such extreme conditions impressed him, and he grew concerned about their ability to continue surviving as humans infiltrated the desert. Encountering these plants, especially those facing conservation challenges, was almost an epiphany for me, says Guerrero of the Universidad de Concepción in Chile. Cacti in the Atacama are particularly vulnerable to disturbances. Many species are found in only a few square kilometers of the desert, and in the driest reaches, cacti depend on fog alone for water. But as the desert gets hotter and drier due to climate change, the fog is disappearing in some places. Humans' direct impact on the Atacama is increasing, too. In Guerrero's youth and earlier in his research career, the only way to access remote hotspots of biodiversity was to trek through the desert on foot. As the mining and energy industries began to grow, more roads were built, turning hours-long treks into quick drives. Litter now pools alongside the roadside, Guerrero says. Once bursting spots feel lifeless, haunted by desiccated cacti husks. Because the desert is so dry, remains are slow to decompose and linger for years, and many remaining cacti populations are sparse. Comparing today's populations with historical photos, it's easy to see the change in the presence of plants, Guerrero says. They're much less abundant now. In recent years, he began hearing from colleagues about an increasing number of cacti being seized at the Chilean border. Interest in having cacti as houseplants has grown around the world, and so has cactus theft. From the American Southwest to South Africa, desert plants have been targets of plant poaching. Even the remote Atacama wasn't safe. How, he wondered, was poaching affecting the desert's cacti? Guerrero looked to Copiapoa, a diverse genus found mainly in the Atacama that has been a hot commodity in recent years. From his field visits, it seemed obvious that many species were threatened, if not already near extinction. In a 2015 assessment, 28% of the species and subspecies were classified as critically endangered or endangered, but nearly half of the 39 known species and subspecies hadn't been evaluated. Guerrero used new evolutionary histories of the species, careful mapping, and outside experts to reclassify the genus's extinction risk. The results were stark. 76% of all Copiapoa species and subspecies are critically endangered or endangered, drastically more than the 2015 assessment's finding. 28% of Copiapoa species and subspecies were classified as critically endangered or endangered, but nearly half of the 39 known species and subspecies hadn't been evaluated. Guerrero used new evolutionary histories of the species, careful mapping, and outside experts to reclassify Copiapoa's extinction risk. The results were stark. 76% of all Copiapoa species and subspecies are critically endangered or endangered, drastically more than the 2015 assessment's finding. Guerrero then analyzed factors of extinction risk, such as landscape condition, human footprint, plant poaching, and legal trade, to determine which factors were most likely responsible for the increase. Poaching and trade clearly stood out, affecting almost all critically endangered species, he and colleagues reported in the journal Conservation Biology. "The situation is really bad," he said. Determined to help conserve the Atacama's cacti, he is researching how the cacti are surviving despite the disturbances, and collaborating on state and international efforts to document poaching. Creating new conservation areas with the greatest biodiversity and training park rangers to identify rare cacti are essential, he says. But the rapid rise of extinction risk for the Atacama's cacti alarms him. I'm scared for the future of some of these species. And this news article, this botanist is on a mission to save the Atacama's cacti, appears in the February 2025 issue of Science News. And from the December 2024 issue of Scientific American, The Science of Health. Everyday concussions. Hidden brain injuries are surprisingly common. New diagnostics may improve outcomes, by Lydia Denworth. 15 years ago, I slipped on a wet patio deck and fell backward, slamming the back of my skull into a pillar. I saw stars and briefly felt nauseated. But I picked myself up, checked that I wasn't bleeding, and went about my day. The back of my head was sore for a few days, but there weren't any lingering effects, and I didn't see a doctor. Still, those symptoms I did have might have been signs of a concussion, the common term for a mild traumatic brain injury, or TBI. Such injuries are a lot more common than you might think, and may cause long-term problems. When more than 600 average middle-aged people in the UK and Ireland were asked careful questions about past incidents in which they might have hit their heads, a full third turned out to have suffered a TBI of some kind. And nearly 3 million people in the US are officially diagnosed with a TBI every year in emergency departments and hospitals. About 75 to 80% of their injuries are described as mild. But mild, it turns out, can have consequences years later for many people. For example, in 2023, the multi-center TRACK TBI study revealed that out of more than 1,200 people, 33% of those with mild TBI and 30% of those with moderate or severe TBI showed deterioration 1 to 7 years after injury. Complaints can include problems sleeping, headaches, and memory and psychiatric issues. Long-term, a TBI can lead to dementia, and it may also trigger several types of cardiovascular disease. Doctors have misunderstood or misdiagnosed these problems because of an old way of looking at and thinking about concussions. For 50 years, physicians have relied on symptoms they observe, such as loss of consciousness and motor or verbal changes, and on patient reports, to classify traumatic brain injury as mild, moderate, or severe. But this system isn't very accurate at predicting either short or long-term outcomes. Experts have been pushing for change for several years. A 2022 National Academies report listed reclassification of these three grades based on stronger evidence as its first recommendation. We know these terms are not accurate. They're not precise. In fact, they can actually be problematic for patients, says Sini Umo, who is the TBI program director at the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, or NINDS. Now the field is doing something about the problem. After a January 2024 meeting hosted by NINDS, experts are proposing a new system of diagnosis and classification that provides neurobiological detail instead of a vague term such as mild. Called the CBIM model, it includes clinical symptoms, C, blood-based biomarkers, B, imaging, I, and modifiers, M. The last item includes social determinants of health, such as access to care. If doctors use this model, they will have to approach concussions and their treatment differently. Breast cancer patients, for instance, are not told that their cancer is mild or severe, but are informed of the exact size of the tumor, whether it is estrogen receptor positive, and so on. People with a potential TBI could get that level of detail. Under the proposed guidelines, they will get a TBI score on a scale based on their responsiveness to a clinician's questions, as they do today, as well as blood biomarker results and possibly imaging results. The biomarkers are proteins released in the brain in response to injury. New technology can measure concentrations of these proteins in the bloodstream. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved two tests for the proteins GFAP and UCHL1 that can predict whether intracranial lesions are present in the brain and whether a CT scan is warranted to confirm them. Someone with no visible changes in imaging and low blood biomarkers would be told that their recovery prognosis was good. Someone with more worrisome indicators might be told to follow up with specialists over months or even years. Physicians would adjust these risk assessments based on modifiers. For example, a person with a history of mental health issues is at higher risk than someone without. What we need to do is pay more attention to what happens in the months and years after injury, says neurologist David Sharp of Imperial College London. The way to do that is to do blood tests for particular things we think are relevant. And non-protein biomarkers are turning up too. Neuroscientist Audrey Lowe of the University of Cambridge and the Mayo Clinic used imaging to uncover signs of cerebral small vessel disease, a risk factor for dementia. One such sign, tiny chronic brain hemorrhages called microbleeds, was associated with past TBIs. The more TBIs a person had, the more likely they were to have had these microbleeds. Implementing more standardized tools to screen for traumatic brain injury could be a way to pick these up, Lowe says. Such screening will also allow doctors to better assess the risk of dementia. Fortunately, healthcare providers now take mild TBI far more seriously than in the past, when you'd have been told, "You've had your bell rung and you're fine," says neuropsychiatrist Thomas W. McAllister of the Indiana University School of Medicine. Thanks in part to modern concussion protocols, which call for several days of cognitive and physical rest, followed by other supervised treatments, most patients do feel better in a few weeks or months if diagnosed properly. And the new methods should help even more. The author of this column, Lydia Denworth, is an award-winning science journalist and contributing editor for Scientific American. She is also the author of Friendship, which was published by W.W. Norton in 2020. Her column, Everyday Concussions, Hidden Brain Injuries Are Surprisingly Common, appears in the December 2024 issue of Scientific American. A new nonfiction book has been published entitled Marie Curie, Mentor to Women or Martyr to Science. In a new biography, Dava Sobel, who edits the column Meter, which opened this program today, focuses not just on the legendary physicist and chemist, but on the 45 women who worked in her lab. The article is written by Kate Zernicki, who is a reporter at the New York Times. She is the author of The Exceptions, Nancy Hopkins and the Fight for Women in Science. The article was posted on October 10th, 2024. The book, written by Dava Sobel, is entitled The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science. In June 1921, in the flush of a triumphant six-week American tour by Marie Curie, a prominent male scientist urged the young women graduating from Bryn Mawr to follow her example and enter into a career of science. An unsigned editorial in the New York Times scoffed, not to take anything from the illustrious Madame Curie, then the only woman to have won a Nobel Prize, and the only person to have won twice. But surely, the editorial opined, the young women must have understood that such achievement was not for them. While some might be efficient in the laboratory for drudgery and perhaps original investigation, most had yet to develop the scientific or mechanical mind. Men had more latent capacities in those directions. Women were too emotional to view the facts abstractly. The Times was, to use the old newspaper cliché, not alone. Back home in Paris, the French Academy of Sciences refused to elect her a member. It later repeatedly rebuffed her daughter, who also won a Nobel Prize. In her new biography, The Elements of Marie Curie, Dava Sobel quotes a letter from a Yale professor recounting Curie's American visit, saying he was pleasantly surprised to find she was quite keen about scientific matters. "But I feel sorry for the poor old girl," he added. "She was a distinctly pathetic figure." The belief that women lack the intrinsic aptitude to master math and science stubbornly persists. As Sobel begins her book, "Even now, nearly a century after her death, Marie Curie remains the only female scientist whom most people can name." Previous chroniclers of women in science, especially Margaret Rossiter in her three-volume book on the Americans among them, have argued that Curie's exceptional achievement made it harder for women who aspired to follow her. They already suspected they'd have to be twice as good to get half as far. She made the standard more unattainable and gave cover to male department heads looking for an excuse not to hire them. She's likable enough, but she's no Marie Curie. Sobel, the author of several scientific biographies, Longitude was a bestseller, and Galileo's Daughter, a Pulitzer Prize finalist, looks for a more positive result. She sets out to show how Curie's discovery of radium lit a path for women in science, namely the 45 aspiring female scientists who spent a formative period in the Curie lab at the Sorbonne. But her telling confirms, heartbreakingly at times, just how narrow and gloomy the path was. Curie herself was able to have a lab of her own because her husband, the physicist Pierre Curie, demanded that the school where he worked give her the space. Her father-in-law moved in with a couple to babysit for their two children. After Pierre Curie and Marie Curie shared the Nobel Prize, the Sorbonne gave Pierre a professorial chair. Marie was relegated to chief of operations in his new lab. The university made her its first female professor only in 1906, after Pierre was killed by a horse-drawn wagon on a rainy night near the Pont Neuf. As with so many early women in science, Curie's is a story of self-sacrifice. Before she met her husband Pierre, she nearly starved herself, living on tea and bread as she studied in a Parisian garret. After his death, she dressed in black and shunned attention. Urged to write a memoir, she wrote his biography instead. She poured what paltry prize money she won back into buying bits of radium for her research. With rare exceptions, the 45 other women subjects appear in Sobel's book only as emanations. Sobel names her chapters for them, but tells little of their stories beyond that. One, Irene Goetz, is mentioned in only one sentence in the chapter named for her. Two get fuller treatment. After Barnard College told Harriet Brooks she had to quit because she was getting married, she did. Her job as a physics instructor, and the engagement, too, only to sacrifice her career for another marriage down the road. Ellen Gleditsch became a university professor in Norway, but after 13 years, the university still refused to grant her tenure or lab space. Support came from several men, one of whom referred to his wife as BG for beautiful genius. When Curie, 4 years widowed, was attacked as immoral for an affair with a married man, Albert Einstein defended her. The man in question went on to have a child out of wedlock with a former student working in his lab. Predictably, no scandal ensued. By contrast, the women in Sobel's book doubted themselves and Curie. Some noted that she barely showed up in the lab as her health declined from years of exposure to the radioactivity she had discovered. And those who did try to improve conditions for women often worried that such efforts only distracted them from their scientific passions. As one suffragist scientist wrote, "I often think very sadly that I might have been more useful to the cause if I had devoted myself to my own special work, as Madame Curie has done." As in her earlier books, Sobel writes elegantly about science, unspooling Curie's pursuits in the lab like a mystery. She leaves us less clear how Curie herself viewed the position of women in science. When a member of the Nobel Committee suggested that she not come to Stockholm to collect her second prize in 1911 because of the bad publicity around her affair, she insisted on going. "I believe there is no connection between my scientific work and the facts of private life." But when Gleditsch and others formed an international society devoted to promoting women in science, Curie declined to ally herself. Her ailments debilitated her so much that she begged off several events on her American tour. Her exposure to the very elements she had discovered ultimately killed her. The Times ran its obituary on the front page of July 5, 1934. "Madame Curie is dead. Martyr to science." This review by Kate Zernike, a national reporter at the Times, reviews the book, The Elements of Marie Curie, How the Glow of Radium Lit a Path for Women in Science, written by Dava Sobel, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. This review was posted in the New York Times on October 10, 2024. And finally, a New York Times trilobite, posted on October 11, 2024, by Jack Tomisiea. "Hairballs shed light on man-eating lion's menu. The Tsavo man-eaters terrorized railroad workers in British East Africa in the 19th century, but their tastes went well beyond human flesh. In British East Africa in 1898, two lions living along the Tsavo River were hungry. This was bad news for the workers building a railroad there. They would retreat to their tents at night, and come morning, some of the men would be missing, the latest victims of big cats that had a hankering for human meat. Bones, flesh, skin, and blood, they devoured all and left not a trace behind them," wrote Lieutenant Colonel John Henry Patterson, a British Army officer leading the railroad project. During the nine-month reign of the Tsavo man-eaters, the lions, which like most males of the area lacked manes, devoured around 35 workers. Eventually, construction of the railroad stopped completely until Colonel Patterson shot the two cats. The lions' bodies were initially fashioned into trophy rugs. In 1925, the Field Museum in Chicago purchased the rugs for a display. The two skulls ended up in the museum's collection. It turns out that the Tsavo lions had a taste for more than men. Using hair fragments preserved in the lion's broken teeth, scientists discovered DNA from several species. Their findings were published a few weeks ago in the journal Current Biology, offering a snapshot of the surprisingly diverse buffet of wildlife once consumed by a top predator in what is today Kenya. In the 1990s, Thomas B. Ganaska, a collections manager at the Field Museum, got a chance to examine the Tsavo lion's skulls. He noticed hair fragments in the cat's cracked canine teeth. In 2001, Mr. Gonoski contributed to a paper positing that the lions had developed a preference for human prey because the cat's teeth were damaged and our species' flesh was easier to chew. In the new paper, Mr. Gonoski teamed up with other researchers to further flesh out the Tsavo lions' diets by examining the century-old hair fragments with microscopy and cutting-edge genetic analysis. Snippets of DNA found in the lion's teeth matched the hair fragments with several species, including oryx, waterbuck, zebra, and giraffe. According to Ross Barnett, a paleogeneticist who was not involved in the new study, hair is a hardy source of preserved DNA. You can dunk it in bleach to remove surface contaminants, but the DNA inside the keratinous layers will be unaffected, he said. The hair packed inside the Tsavo lion's broken teeth proved to be a dietary time capsule. "We were looking at these tooth cavities in the same way geologists look at soil," said Alida de Fomming, a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and the lead author of the new study. "Analyzing hairs from different layers should give us an idea of the lifetime diets of these lions." The team focused on mitochondrial DNA in the hair fragments, which provide abundant genetic information that is relatively easy to decipher. They compared these snippets of DNA with the genetic record of species native to the Tsavo region and matched the hair fragments with several species, including oryx, waterbuck, zebra, and giraffe. I was pleasantly surprised when we were able to actually identify various species that were authentic for that age, said Ripon S. Mali, a molecular anthropologist who works with Dr. De Fleming at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. The team discovered surprises in the hair samples. Modern Tsavo lions prefer Cape buffalo, but the man-eating lions had virtually no buffalo hair in their teeth, an absence consistent with the speed of rinderpest, a cattle disease, through Africa in the 1890s. The team was also surprised to uncover DNA from wildebeest, a species that was not common then in the Tsavo region. This finding may help corroborate historical records suggesting that the lions left the rail encampment for nearly 6 months before resuming their killing spree. There was even genetic material from the lions themselves in the sample. By comparing the two predators' mitochondrial DNA, which is transmitted by maternal lineage, the team confirmed the theory that the two lions were siblings. The sample also contained DNA from multiple human individuals. Dating these hair samples may provide clues to when the lions first preyed on people. However, the researchers avoided further deciphering these remains until they could work more closely with local communities, which may be home to descendants of the lions' victims. Tsavo communities continue to live alongside lions, and the danger that these predators pose is still real. What strikes me about the Tsavo story is that it is almost incomprehensible to a 21st century Western mindset, Dr. Barnett said. The terror that the night must have brought is unimaginable. This New York Times trilobite, Hairballs Shed Light on Man-Eating Lion's Menu, was posted on October 11th, 2024, in the New York Times. And that brings us to the end of today's broadcast of Science Matters. My name is Cynthia Ellick, and I've been your host today on Sun Sounds of Arizona. And remember, if you missed any part of this program, you can access it on demand at sunsounds.org and click Broadcast Info and Audio. Thank you so much for listening, and please join me again next week.